I'm Kyle Crawford. This week on War News Radio, we bring you a new program from our sister studio, the Sudan Radio Project. The UN estimates that since 2003, violence in the Darfur region of Western Sudan has left as many as 300,000 people dead and forced 2.7 million from their homes. Each month, the Sudan Radio Project aims to take a deeper look at the conflicts in Darfur and elsewhere in Sudan. Their reporting ranges from personal stories of Sudanese refugees to critical analysis of Sudan's history and political landscape. Take a listen.
You're listening to the Sudan Radio Project. I'm your host, Rob Fain. This month, entering the arena, first, we hear about U.S.-Sudan relations in the past two decades and how major events like the September 11th attacks have shaped them. Next, an update on current tensions and progress made in the North and South surrounding the referendum. Then, a look at the African Championship of Nations, a soccer tournament to be hosted by Sudan in February 2011. And last, we learn about the concerns at the United Nations about potential conflict arising from the upcoming January referendum, and if it even happens at all. The United States and Sudan have struggled with rocky relations since the 1990s, due to Sudan's support of Iraq during the United States-Kuwait invasion, and their harboring of key al-Qaeda figures including Osama bin Laden. Accordingly, Sudan was, and still is, officially designated by the United States as a sponsor of terrorism. Maria Thompson has more on the development of U.S.-Sudan relations since then.
In 2000, Sudan and the United States entered into a bilateral counterterrorism dialogue, easing mounting political stress over international security. However, the recently eased tensions flared up again after al-Qaeda terrorist attacks in the United States on September 11, 2001. The Sudanese government denied involvement or association with the terrorists, and over the past decade, the United States has collaborated with Sudan on a series of peace-building efforts. Steve Paterno, a Sudanese journalist for the Sudan Tribune, discusses the effect that the 9/11 terrorist attacks had on U.S.-Sudanese relations.
The 9/11 created a paradox in U.S. policy, because Sudan has been known as one of the sponsor states of terrorism. But after 9/11, the U.S. got involved with intelligence gathering from Sudan. That was after they put the Sudan in the list of state-sponsored terrorism, until today, by the way. So the paradox is that, on one hand, the U.S. is trying to pressure the Sudan government on the human rights issues. And on one hand, is they're collaborating with Sudan on intelligence issues. And that actually put U.S. in an awkward situation on what really leverage the U.S. have on the Sudan government, which is in Khartoum.
Dr. Martina Nichols, an independent consultant who in 2005 was part of a team that evaluated two of the larger peace programs, also discusses how these attacks affected aid and funding.
Post 9/11, through the 4 years, it was really the American government's aim was to really keep things steady and to support the citizens in Sudan in the conflict zones. So it was a very tense time for them, and it was a very unsure time for the Americans in terms of their funding support. They wanted to keep a level. They couldn't really increase it until they knew peace was holding, but they knew they had to do something.
According to Dr. Nichols, the two programs that she evaluated, the Sudan Peace Fund and the South Sudan Transitions Initiative, both American-funded programs, went a long way in improving these tense interactions and helped to build a foundation for the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005.
These programs were to set up peace committees, peace dialogues, to also work in some smaller infrastructure programs and a level of assistance where they could work towards a peaceful coexistence. Comprehensive peace agreement and the way it was disseminated to people in villages and local government made the people more confident that peace was going to last. And one of the reasons we found was that the American government had started to build not just temporary structures, but concrete and brick structures. And once the people of Sudan saw them, they realized that the Americans were there to help them over the long term, and that these structures represented some form of permanence rather than people transiting through. So that, again, gave hope.
In addition to these peace-building projects, Dr. Nichols also stated that the United States education programs in Sudan were beneficial to the relations between the two countries.
The education programs go back a long time because with the conflicts, Sudan's literacy rate was probably the poorest in the world. It was very difficult at the time to keep schools open. But with funding from the American government, these were able to, at some stage, keep going. So now, with this long history of education by the Americans, their success in the education field, and this is still maintained now with links between Sudan and American support. And I think we find now that the American government are quite, and rightly so, should be quite proud of a lot of their initiatives, such as the scholarship for girls. So now there's great success in getting the enrollments up. And so this link, with the education link between Sudan and America, I think is very strong.
At the individual level, however, some tensions were unavoidable. Paterno explains.
When something is said on the news, like, for example, Secretary of State was quoted saying, in order for the South to succeed, the South must compromise and accommodate. So what does that really mean, you know? From American perspective, maybe it makes sense, but really there's nothing that South can compromise or even accommodate after they sign an agreement, after so many years of war, after so many years of people dying. So from American perspective, it makes sense, because in any negotiation, somebody has to compromise or accommodate new ideas, but that's not the case.
Dr. Nichols also explains the perceptions Sudanese people have of American aid providers.
I was living in a tent for 6 months, and a lot of people were living in tents or very basic accommodation. And so often there's tension even amongst aid workers. Not so much about policies or things like that. It's just close living quarters. It's like a family living closely together. There's always going to be some tension. But I think generally the Sudanese knew that people were there to help. They knew that once there was the influx of aid workers, there was also the rise of construction. So then it started to present opportunities for them, opportunities for work and so forth. So it was a tough time for everyone. But gradually, with the training of aid workers, particularly the Americans, because they supported the technical assistance in the ministries, and to individual Sudanese working in the government.
The Southern Sudanese referendum, currently set to take place in January 2011, will be a further test of the United States' role in supporting Sudan in maintaining relative peace.
So would the U.S. put pressure on Khartoum to abide by the agreement so the referendum take place on time and fair and free? I think that's a big question. Would they put more pressure on the South to compromise on some of the issues, then the referendum may be delayed and things like that? The U.S. actually have a policy where they say the Khartoum don't do this, they will do this. The policy is out there, that is their stand on this issue. How far can that go? That is a challenge now for the U.S. government.
Recently, President Obama has stressed the need for the Sudanese National Congress Party to work on resolving its differences with the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, and has discussed with former South African President Thabo Mbeki about, quote, the importance of moving ahead aggressively to support the negotiations and resisting any entreaties to delay, unquote. Last Monday, November 1st, President Obama also renewed United States sanctions on Sudan as an effort to keep pressure on the country to hold the referendum on time. The Sudanese referendum, therefore, will be a determining point for where U.S.-Sudan relations go in the future. For the Sudan Radio Project, this is Maria Thompson.
In January, a referendum is scheduled to be held in South Sudan to determine whether the region will remain a part of Sudan or whether it will secede and become an independent country. The referendum is one facet of a 2005 peace agreement signed between the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, which is the main rebel group in Sudan, and the National Congress Party, or NCP, which ruled in the north at the time that the agreement was signed. Nick Gatino has more.
Although the peace accords that are directly causing the referendum were signed only 5 years ago, in 2005, the tensions leading to the agreement have been causing conflict in Sudan since 1947, when the British powers that were in Sudan at the time decided that the north and south would become one country. It was largely this decision that sparked the inception of the Southern Sudan Liberation Movement and, in 1955, the first civil war in Sudan. The war ended 17 years later with the Addis Ababa Agreement, which granted the south regional autonomy. However, continued violence led to the creation of the SPLM and the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA, in 1983. Since their founding, these groups have fought for the creation of what they call New Sudan, or an independent nation out of what is now South Sudan. Voter registration for the referendum is scheduled to begin on November 15th. Still, there have been numerous reports claiming that the NCP wants to delay the referendum until border disputes between the North and South are resolved. According to a July report from the BBC, the NCP believes that a vote on a possible new country without a clear border would be a recipe for a new war. One BBC correspondent further speculates that this stance is meant either to delay the referendum or to encourage the South to yield disputed territories to the North. Even so, Southern Sudanese officials seem to be, for the most part, intent on holding the referendum as planned. Whether or not the referendum takes place on the planned date, tensions are building up around the voting process. The SPLM's Secretary of Information, Culture, and Communications told reporters this week that there have been accounts of instances where Southern Sudanese people in North Sudan were refused medical treatment at hospitals unless they promised to vote for unity. The same secretary also reported that many Southern Sudanese residing in Khartoum are moving out of the north and back to South Sudan. The Sudan Tribune quoted him as saying that he has been told that in 1 hour, 90 buses and 38 trucks leave Khartoum for South Sudan. This may cause North Sudan to not have a registration center for voters, as the Referendum Act states that centers need to be established only in areas where there are concentrations of more than 20,000 eligible voters. If the Southern Sudanese population in the north falls below that, voting may only be available in the south. Post-referendum arrangements, should the south decide to secede, also continue to be a point of tension. During the post-referendum conference held in July of this year, the SPLM and NCP discussed post-referendum governance of the south. The Secretary General of the SPLM, Pagana Moon, pushed to ensure the rights of both northern and southern Sudanese citizens.
The SPLM, they stand here to offer a promise to the people of Sudan, whether they are southerners or northerners, from western Sudan or eastern Sudan, that we shall negotiate in good faith with the National Congress Party and strive to reach agreement on all the post-referendum issues. And our aim will be to ensure peace, protect all the livelihoods, respect customary rights of our people, honor the connection of our peoples and their shared histories, prevent discrimination or hardship or loss of human rights to all, honor our international duties and obligations under law, prioritize reconciliation, ensure economic viability of both South and North, and seek to forge continued economic, social and cultural cooperation between the people of Sudan in the south and in the north.
4 months later, the Sudan Tribune quoted Kamal Obeid, the Sudanese information minister, as saying that if South Sudan opts for independence, they will not enjoy citizenship rights, jobs, or benefits. He said they will not be allowed to buy or sell in the Khartoum market, and that they will not be treated in hospitals. We will not even give them a needle in the hospital, he said. There are many obstacles still to be addressed in the referendum process. Still, the Southern Sudanese remain hopeful. Recently, South Sudanese Vice President Riek Machar Tani was quoted as saying, nothing will stop the people of southern Sudan from determining their political destiny. For the Sudan Radio Project, this is Nick Catino.
Mina Itabashi and Maxim's News Network also contributed to this report. In 2009, the first edition of the African Championship of Nations, a biannual soccer tournament, was held in the Ivory Coast, and was won by the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Next February, the tournament will be held in Sudan, with 16 nations, including Sudan, competing. Danny Herschel Burns explores public sentiment regarding the tournament.
Unlike most soccer tournaments, the African Championship of Nations restricts the eligibility of players to those who play in their own national leagues. With so many African players participating in European and Asian leagues today, the talent pool is significantly reduced for some nations. Despite the absence of major international stars, the tournament will give a chance to some lesser-known players to showcase their talents. Oliver Tunda, a Sudanese immigrant and neighborhood councilman living in Washington, D.C., expresses his take on the tournament and Sudanese soccer.
I think at the moment, the state of Sudanese soccer is not really that great. My personal opinion, I think the Sudanese soccer has been rocked by politics. You know, the instability in the country has contributed to the low level of the Sudanese soccer. Sudan, like any other African country, has been applying politics into soccer. You know, players who are really very good, sometimes they don't get the chance to play for the national team simply because they have nobody to back them up there. And those players who have got people in the government, no matter how bad they play, in most cases they get the opportunity to represent Sudan. That's the situation. So the best thing to improve it is that soccer has to be played in such a way that take the best players to play, no matter whether they have people in the government or not.
The preparation for the tournament is another unresolved issue. Tunda again.
I am very skeptical. I'm not quite sure what's really doing. There are going to be 16 African countries, actually, 15 plus Sudan. I'm afraid that at the moment, there has been no indication where the tournament is going to take place exactly in Sudan, which are going to be the cities. It has not been made public yet. Given where the Sudan is today, I do not think CAF made the right decision to give Sudan to host the tournament.
However, Alauddin Yusuf, who lives in Khartoum, has a different opinion.
I don't think there's problems.
While Yusuf does not see the problems in holding the tournament itself, he believes that the government is putting too much money into Sudanese soccer.
It's helped too much.
Oliver Tunda feels differently about the government's financial role.
Sudan has the money. If Sudan wants really to fund, you know, a soccer in Sudan, the Sudan government can do that without any problem. There's a lot of money in Sudan. So probably the question is a neglect of soccer. Soccer is left to those who love soccer, but the government is not doing enough. The Sudan is technically in a state of war. The conflict in Darfur has not been resolved. There are issues still with the upcoming referendum. Of course, the tournament is going to be in February. But the build-up to the referendum, we don't know what is going to happen in the referendum. The conflict in Darfur, we still have not seen any progress in trying to resolve the conflict. So these are issues that are very, very, very serious that may affect the tournament. It may even disrupt the tournament going on.
Tunda also explains the opportunity the tournament gives to local players.
And that also gives them the chances of, you know, if they are very good, to be marketable to Europe or some other continents where, you know, playing there is good. I mean, that's going to expose those local players because they have been only playing locally. So the only time for them to really shine, at least to be seen internationally, is to participate in this tournament. Not many people actually watch the African Club Championship that much. You find that in Africa, most Africans watch European soccer, the Premier League, you know, the Italian League and so forth. So the local league in Africa Not many Africans are going to watch that. So probably this is an opportunity to give the local to be watched all over Africa and even other continents.
Tunde also speaks about his expectations for the Sudanese team.
We have not seen, I have not actually seen the Sudanese team playing in that issue. I would think Sudan probably is not going to be a first record win. They have not, up to now, they have not actually divided the teams, the 16 teams into groups. It is impossible to say whether the Sudanese team is going to advance in the first round or not, because the opponents of the Sudanese team are still not known. That is going to be known very soon when the fixture is done.
The possibility of the Sudanese team winning the tournament is one topic that both Yusuf and Tunde agree on. Yusuf.
Well, I don't think that. It's too far. Right now it's too far. I think it's going to take about 3 or 4 years to be in that place.
The public opinion of the tournament is summed up by Yusuf.
Well, they love it so much, you know. Everybody know the championship. Everybody like it. Well, they have too much activities.
Taking into consideration these present problems in Sudan's political and governmental situation, the African Championship of Nations seems to have a long way to go before reaching the ideal tournament envisioned by Tunde.
A perfect tournament is a tournament where, you know, a tournament played where there is peace and tranquility in the country, a tournament played in areas where everybody is very enthusiastic to see the tournament, a tournament played in an atmosphere of peace and tranquility.
For the Sudan Radio Project, this is Danny Herschel-Brentz.
Sudan has increasingly gained the attention of the international community, especially with the upcoming referendum. This October, the United Nations Security Council traveled to Sudan and other neighboring African countries. It met with the country's citizens and leaders to discuss the issues that face Sudan both leading up to and after the voting. At the end of this month, the Security Council issued a report discussing the possibility of another civil war erupting in Sudan if the international community does not work toward a fair and cooperative referendum. Emma Sorrell has more.
Both the North-South referendum and the Abyei referendum are set to take place in Sudan on January 9th. But as the date gets closer, there are still many provisions that must be met if both are to go smoothly. Recently, the international community has become increasingly involved in Sudan's affairs. Catherine Mercier, the UN correspondent to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, talks about the sudden interest that the international community has taken in Sudan.
Seems like for many years not much has been done, and now in the few months leading up to the referendum, everyone is sort of waking up and thinking, oh, we really need to make this happen. People have to vote. It has to be like a transparent, credible referendum. And very little has been done. I was reading again the Secretary General's report on that this morning, and people were not able to agree on who was going to lead this referendum effort and who was going to make sure that all the votes will be counted and that people actually are on the voting lists. That's very difficult in a country where a lot of people are not registered.
Another problem that Sudan faces is where to draw borders. Many countries have been involved in redistricting Abyei, figuring out which parts belong to the south and to the north. The Sudanese ambassador to the UN, Dafa Ala El-Hag Ali Osman, says that if issues such as where the borders should be drawn are not resolved in time, civil war could erupt.
Both parties agreed to the idea of the referendum, and they both committed to the date, which is the 9th of January, but there are some pending issues which we prefer and wish those pending issues be resolved before the referendum. And as I said in the beginning, the referendum is a tool, it's not an objective. It's a tool which people think it would lead to stability and peace. But imagine if the pending issues are not resolved, like the demarcation of borders. That would leave a chance for, you know, the possibility of war to erupt. And that is why we always say that the Security Council should concentrate to help both parties to agree and to come to an agreement regarding the demarcation of borders, regarding the status of Abyei, because if these are not solved, this will remain and represent time bombs.
But although the international community may want to help, the role countries should play is debatable. Catherine Mercier explains.
It's widely known that the institutions in South Sudan are not ready for independence. There's, not enough civil servants. It's been a country dealing with a civil war for the last few decades, so they have a lot of soldiers and military personnel, but they don't have a lot of civil servants, people who could run a country. And if a country like the United States wants to help South Sudan right now, looking forward, thinking, oh, if they do secede, they need to be ready, well, then it's like taking sides, and that's very difficult to do. So the hands of countries or the international community, if you will, are tied.
Furthermore, sharing power and resources such as oil is another contested issue. UN correspondent to Voice of America, Margaret Bashir, traveled with the Security Council in October to Sudan, where she talked to citizens.
You know, this is a major problem. When the South has the oil and the North has the refineries, it can be a divorce, but it needs to be an amicable divorce. And there needs to be provisions for both sides. So there needs to be a wealth sharing. And the issue of security, there's so many factors. Plus, you have a lot of Southerners who are living in the North. So what's going to happen to them? We've heard reports that they're being discriminated against, they're being intimidated, they're being threatened. So what's going to happen to them if the South secedes? Will they have to leave the North? Will they have to go back to the South to be safe? What will happen to them?
There are many problems that still need to be dealt with in Sudan if the referendums are to happen. Margaret Bashir says that there is a good chance that either they will not happen or the date will be postponed.
President Bashir was sort of making comments in Libya at the Arab League meeting while the council was still even in Sudan, saying, well, there's still issues to be settled before we can have a referendum. So there's been mixed signals on the subject of whether it's even going to happen on time on January 9th. And I think we can pretty safely say it won't happen in Abyei, in the disputed region of Abyei, which is very oil-rich itself. So I think, you know, with resources come problems, too. So there's a lot of bickering over who has the rights to the resources in Abyei, who's the citizen there, who's eligible to vote. So I really don't think it's likely that there'll be a referendum in Abyei on January 9th. But hopefully the North-South one will still go ahead.
Although there are many challenges that must be overcome before the referendum occurs, with the help and oversight of the international community, the outcome will more likely be fair and peaceful. With Sudan Radio Project, this is Emma Sorrell.
Celia Foster also contributed to this report. You've been listening to the Sudan Radio Project. That's all for this month. Special thanks to Daniel Duncan and Shilpa Bupana for behind-the-scenes support. The Sudan Radio Project is sponsored by Project Pericles. Learn more about us and listen to past shows at sudanradioproject.org. Thanks for tuning in.